My name is Joan Hunt. This is a session on the beginning of the Book of Revelation. It will be a session that we're doing today. It's kind of about what is Revelation about? How can you read Revelation and begin to make sense of it? If you're able to come back the other days of this week for Bible study, we'll be looking at other chunks of Revelation as we go through, but any day will be a self-contained episode in itself. I'm trying to use the image of science fiction, like Star Trek, for example, or the Star Wars series might have some connections too, to help us get a handle on what kind of literature Revelation is. Because you know that if you pick up a newspaper, for instance, you don't read every page just the same. If you have the front page with headlines and news stories, you understand those in one way. That might be, that hopefully is different from how you look at the editorial page. That's different from how you look at the want ads. That's different from how you read the comics. That's different from how you read the advertisements. So that when the Nordstrom ad says best sale of the year, you don't automatically take that the same way you take 3,000 killed in Bangladesh on the front page or something like that. So what kind of writing is the Book of Revelation? What is Revelation trying to accomplish? Now, to get started, I'd like you to just rapid fire surface some of the feelings that rise in you when you hear Book of Revelation. How does the thought of the Book of Revelation make you feel?
Hard to read.
Mysterious.
Symbols. End of the world.
Yeah,
the book I never read.
Fearful. Yeah? Oh, that's high. Okay. And then let's try something a little bit longer than one word. If you had a phrase or a sentence, how would you summarize what you think Revelation is about?
A message to comfort the people of that time.
Can everybody hear that? Message to comfort the people of that time. Kind of a...
It's also a communion liturgy.
A lot of our communion liturgy comes from Revelation. Mm-hmm. Any other ways to try to summarize the whole attempt of Revelation?
Hope.
Key point. I was in college when I fell in love with somebody and went home with him for Christmas. And while we were at his family's home at Christmas time, we went to some nearby church. I think it was their own Lutheran church. I don't even remember. They were showing one of those films about the end of the world, supposedly based on the Book of Revelation, in which the message of it was, you better get your life in order right now, because pretty soon the rapture is going to come, and only true believing Christians are going to disappear then, and everyone else is going to be left on earth to suffer. And since there'll be all the tyrants and bad people and evil ones, those of you who were just kind of lackadaisical and indifferent and had never quite made up your mind to follow Christ are going to be suffering at the hands of these evil, vile, and awful ones. So therefore, I felt it was like a cattle prod, kind of with the electric charge, you know, therefore, get your life in order now. And I really, I was in love, but I didn't lose my theological wits completely. I said, that's not how Revelation is trying to operate. It's not trying to scare the hell out of us. It's trying to give us a message of encouragement and hope, and to say that what needs to be done is doable, and that we can support one another in it. Not only that, but God is supporting us as well. So overall, I really agree with you that the message of Revelation is one of hope. And although over the airwaves and in the popular literature, it's presented as a very scary and frightening book, I hope to be talking about Revelation in a way that will help you hear the affirming word of a powerful and compassionate God underneath it all, encouraging us to, like Garrison Keillor says, stand up and do what needs to be done. Mm-hmm. So, let's check right now and see what John himself says Revelation is at the beginning of chapter 1 of Revelation. right away, chapter 1, verse 1, the revelation of Jesus Christ. This is a revelation, which means an unveiling, which means that something that's hidden is going to be able to be seen now, which means the cover is going to be taken off something, which means if you were to use a puppet stage analogy, that not only what goes on in front of the curtains is going to be able to be seen, but also what goes on behind the scenes. In fact, I recently saw a puppet show and was invited up to the stage afterwards and discovered that down beneath, in the circular area that was covered by curtains, there were rolling carts so the puppeteers could get around the floor and hooks on the wall so they could find other things. Well, all that's going to be exposed now. We're going to see the underpinnings and the overpinnings of history, and we're going to find out who really is in charge. Why is this important to us? Because we are members of seven churches in Turkey, what at that time was called Asia, the province of the Roman Empire. I believe that Revelation was written around the end of the first century, and from before the birth of Christ, as you know, the Romans had been in power. Jesus was born during the time of Caesar Augustus. Caesar was the word for the emperor. And there have been a whole series of emperors since then, and at least from the time of the Emperor Nero in the middle of the century, Christians have been persecuted. They've been increasingly persecuted, so that now here at the end of the century, the emperor's name is Domitian, and he's a little worried about the empire. The empire that the Roman armies have won for Rome and the Roman system spreads around the whole Mediterranean, North Africa, the Mideast, and Europe, England too, United Kingdom too. And there's so many people of so many languages, races, socioeconomic backgrounds, and everything else. And how do you keep a diverse group like that together and unified and under one authority? There are a lot of ways to do it, through armies and occupation forces, through centralized administration, and there was a fantastic civil service system that the Romans operated, but also through symbolic ritualized means. One way maybe you can get everybody to kind of be together is to have everybody worship the same God. Ah, we know they all have their own gods. You have your own God, you have your own God. But how about if we remind everyone that the one on earth who really has the power is the Roman Emperor? And so you can worship the Roman Emperor as God. And Domitian, in fact, around the year 90, had declared that he was Lord and God, and that people would worship him. And this had real practical consequences for those of us who live here in Turkey, in Asia. Let me just say, Asia was the name of the Roman name for the province where we live, in the western part of Turkey. So when John is talking about the churches in Asia, he doesn't mean the church in Thailand and the church in Japan and the church in China. He's talking about seven cities that are in the western part of Turkey. And this claim of the Roman Emperor to be God and Lord has very practical consequences for us. Every year, we as people who live under the auspices of the Roman Empire are expected to declare our loyalty to the Roman Emperor. We're going to stand in line in order to get inside of a worship space where there is an altar, and we're going to take a pinch of incense and drop it on the burning flames of the altar and say, Caesar is Lord. The Roman Emperor is the one who has the last word of authority on earth, and as he now would say, in heaven. He's the one who calls the shots. We are obedient and subservient. What he says goes. We believe in this whole system. We're part of it. We don't contradict it. We support it. We get our living from it, etc., etc. Caesar is Lord. And then when we've done that, they're going to issue us a certificate that says we've done it. And this certificate enables us for the year to come to own property, to participate in a trade union, to buy and sell, to engage in business, to be legal head of the family if we're a man, so that we can call the shots for our own family. And if we don't have this certificate, and if we haven't said Caesar is Lord, we will be politically and economically discriminated against, and we'll also be shunned by all the people in our city who have chosen to worship Caesar, to go along with the system. And how will we make a living for our families? How will we hold our heads up in the streets when people are jeering at us and saying, oh, they haven't done it? How can we survive if we're ostracized like that? So every one of us in this congregation here in Smyrna or Philadelphia or Thyatira or Sardis faces a serious question. Are we going to state our loyalty to the Roman Empire, or are we not? Because we say, as Christians here in this worshiping community, we say, Jesus is Lord. And this is in direct contrast to Caesar is Lord. It's not just a private worship statement, it's a statement about the whole nature of the whole universe, who really has power and authority, who really calls the shots, about what, how life really ought to be lived, about what it means to be truly human. But we're just a little band, kind of, we're a minority. And not only that, but the Roman Empire has the power to grind us under its heel if we don't worship Caesar as Lord. So what are our choices? Well, we can completely boycott the Roman Empire and not say that Caesar is Lord and say Jesus is Lord and support one another in doing that. But that's liable to cost us our lives at the very end of it, and at least in the meantime it will cause us embarrassment and suffering and persecution. There's another alternative, of course, and that is we can go in and put our pinch of incense on the altar and keep our fingers crossed while we're doing it. Mm-hmm. And say, Caesar is Lord, but we don't really mean that, and all the profits we make this year, because we have our little card of loyalty, we're going to put into social justice issues and use for the benefit of our Christian community. And that's a pretty good compromise, don't you think? And that's, what?
Pretty familiar one.
Pretty familiar. Uh-huh, you overheard that. Right. So, back to the beginning of Revelation, with a little feel now for the situation that it's being written into. The revelation of Jesus Christ, which God gave him to show his servants what must soon take place. He made it known by sending his angel to his servant John, who testified to the word of God and to the testimony of Jesus Christ, even to all that he saw. Another word I want to pick out from these verses is testimony, which is another indication of what kind of literature this is or what the book of Revelation is about. Testimony is law court language. There's a witness, and that means somebody is going to be charged with some crimes, and somebody's going to be accused, somebody's going to be defended, somebody's going to make the verdict. And it's not at this point in Revelation clear how that's going to be set up, but there's a testimony here. And so we know that somebody is on trial. And then in verse 3, blessed is the one who reads aloud the words of the prophecy, and blessed are those who hear and who keep what's written in it, for the time is near. This is a reminder to us that people didn't get the book of Revelation in their hand and read it. It was a letter form sent to these seven churches in the west part of Turkey and read out loud to them. So it's too bad we can't read Revelation out loud right now. It's more like listening to Garrison Keillor or somebody else on the radio and letting your imagination go with the pictures you hear than it is seeing black and white words on a page. Keep that in mind. Revelation is a very storytelling kind of experience. And it's a prophecy. A lot of times when people hear a prophecy, they think of something that's predicting something that's going to happen, and the prophecy is is true or not, depending on whether things really work out that way. But prophecy is, as we all know, it's a biblical word that goes back into the Hebrew scriptures and has a noble tradition there. And the emphasis, from my way of reading it, is not so much on the future and what's going to happen as using the future as a way to bounce a light back on the present and get a better grip on what's happening now and what ought to be different, what can be changed. So it's a way of having, if things go on as they're going on now, if we keep living the way we're living, this is the likely outcome of it. Prophecy is sort of a likely future based on where we are now. But not necessarily a future cast in stone, because we're still here and we can still make some changes. And from this point of view, I think that prophecy is like science fiction, because science fiction is a way of talking about the future that extrapolates from the present and tries to suggest how the present could be different, or what choices we have to make along the way that maybe we haven't realized are really choices. So if you take, for example, the Star Trek, the original Star Trek, the TV series, here's an example of something that suggested what the future would be like based on what the present was like. All the computers in the original Star Trek are big machines that have wires, and sparks fly if they happen to get hit during an argument or a fight or something like that. That's what kind of computers they had when Star Trek came out, so they said, well, computers are going to get bigger and better, and they just kind of kept extrapolating along that same line. Not necessarily anything that has worked out really that way. But there are also aspects of the original Star Trek that put a mirror back on the present and on society and said, here's some things that could be different or could be changed, so that in the cast in Star Trek, you have a Russian working side by side with Americans, which was, I think, a really revolutionary thought during the Cold War. And you have a black woman who is the communications officer, another who has a Swahili name, Uhuru. You know, that's another revolutionary kind of thing. It's a way of saying, this is what the future can be like, depending on, different from how it is now, depending on the choices we make now. And I think that prophecy in the Bible, and in Revelation in particular, is a way of saying, this is what it's like now, by holding a mirror up to it. Not only holding a mirror up to it, but the exaggerated images, the dragon, the beasts, the horns, the fantastic numbers, the 140,000, and all of those special numbers, are a way of casting the reflection back to us now, so that we can say, oh, this is the truth. This is the unveiling. You know, now it's uncovered. Now I see how things are really working here in the Roman Empire, and as it affects us here in Sardis or Thyatira or Laodicea, wherever we live. And so now I begin to see what the choices are. And so the book of Revelation is like a journey that means to change our life. Have you ever read a book or seen a film or play or heard a story that changed your life so that you were no longer the same after you read the book than you were before? That's the kind of passage that Revelation wants to be. As we go into it, we are frightened, anxious, worried, oppressed, scared Christians who think that the Roman Empire has all the power and we have none. And we're going to go through this reflection of our life as in a hall of mirrors, or as in this other setting where we can get a better glimpse on it, almost like a Star Trek journey where we meet aliens from other cultures that help us realize what's going on. And as we come out of the journey of the book of Revelation, we're going to be changed in significant ways. One of the changes is that we won't be victims of the empire any longer. We'll be survivors. We will have been healed. we'll still be under the heel of the Roman Empire, but we're not going to be collaborating with them in our minds, which really is the great power that tyrants always have. Not only the force that they have, but the fact that they sell their propaganda to us and we believe it, and we believe that we're weak and powerless and so on. Well, by going through this journey, this voyage of the Book of Revelation, we're going to come out saying, we do have power. It may be the power to give our life up. It's the power to say no, but that is power. So we'll be survivors instead of victims. Along the process, something else that will happen is the Roman Empire will be exposed as an emperor without clothes, or like the great and powerful Oz, you know, just a little man behind a curtain that even a dog can unveil the truth about. To be sure brutal, to be sure with this immense system of armies, to be sure satanic and demonic, but ultimately without power. And we'll discover that by going through the voyage of the Book of Revelation. We'll discover going through Revelation that it's not just a personal and private sort of choice, you know, whether we put the pinch of incense on there or not, but that the personal is political, the private is public, that it makes a difference to the other people in our Christian community, to our whole city, and ultimately could make a difference to the survival of the Roman Empire. It matters what we do in the world. And so all of this is saying the Book of Revelation is not escapist literature. It's not about, you know, getting away and thinking heaven's going to be fine even if earth is the pits. But it's a way of bouncing off there, like bouncing off a satellite to get it, the sound back down here so that we have a sharp image of who it is God is calling us to become, who it is God is empowering us to become. And so what kind of God is it that we say is behind the scenes or around the scenes or working with us that we are trying to get a sharper image of so we can have a sharper image of ourselves? And right there in the first chapter of Revelation, now looking at verse 12 and 13. Maybe you can close your eyes while I read this to you. I turned to see whose voice it was that spoke to me, and on turning I saw seven golden lampstands, and in the midst of the lampstands I saw one like the Son of Man, clothed with a long robe and with a golden sash across his chest. His head and his hair were white as white wool, white as snow. His eyes were like a flame of fire. His feet were like burnished bronze, refined as in a furnace, and his voice was like the sound of many waters. In his right hand he held seven stars, and from his mouth came a sharp two-edged sword, and his face was like the sun shining with full force. What kind of picture is this? What feelings do you have as you hear this picture?
Light and power.
Light and power.
Power.
Mm-hmm.
There's a threat about the sword.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's not just sentimental power, not just sweetness and light, but a real strength. And who is this? Is this some alien from outer space who's just walked into this book? Why doesn't it come out and say real clearly who this is? Well, it's because the writer, John, is in exile, a political prisoner in a penal colony on an island 10 miles by 5 miles in size off the coast of Turkey because he was judged to be dangerous. And he's trying to write a letter back to the congregations that he's worked with in Western Turkey, but who has to get the letter from where he is to there? Has to go through the hands of people in the Roman Empire system. And they're not going to take it if it's too clear, so there's a lot of code language going on here. And as these Roman soldiers hear this, they go, this old man is babbling on and on. Huh, all right, you know, might as well let this through. They'll know that he's cracked up and they won't have any faith in what he says anymore. It would be as if you were listening to Garrison Keillor and didn't know that he was being satirical or something like that. So there are enough clues, though, for us in the Christian community to figure out. We've read the Hebrew scriptures over and over again. And we know then when it says one like a son of man, we're talking about an image from the book of Daniel, an image of a savior, an image of the Messiah, an image of the chosen one who's going to do what God wants to do. And we also know from having heard the stories about Jesus that Jesus liked to refer to himself in third person as Son of Man. He didn't always say, I'm going to do this and I'm going to do that. He said, the Son of Man will come with power. He said, the Son of Man comes to seek and to save those who are lost. And so we put two and two together and we say, well, this is Jesus. And then we say, this is Jesus? Strength and power and a sword holding stars? Hey, and already our self-esteem has risen a little bit as we read this. Now, in the same chapter, in verses 5 and 6, at the beginning of the letter, because this is one more thing that Revelation is a letter, like the letter of Paul to the congregations. This is a letter from John in exile to the people. Three things about Jesus in verse 5. Verse 4, grace to you and peace from him who is and who was and who is to come. What's wonderful about that? God had the first word, God had the last word, and all the words in between. God's own self speaks two times in the book of Revelation, one at the beginning of the book in verse 8 in this chapter, one at the end in chapter 21 or 22. And both times God says, I am the Alpha and the Omega. The Greek alphabet, the Alpha is the first letter and the Omega is the last letter. That means I'm A to Z. I'm it. I'm all there is. I'm all you need to know. And I have all the words, first word, last word, all the words in between. So, grace to you and peace from him who, from the one who is and who was and who is to come, and from the seven spirits who are before the throne. The throne is one of the chief symbols in Revelation, because what's the throne about? Power. And the question of Revelation is, who has power in the world? And the one on the throne and the one at the right hand of the one on the throne have the power. And the seven spirits, we come across that number seven, which appears so often in Revelation. Seven means fullness or completeness. It's like the total of the four that represents the four corners of the earth, and the three, which is the number for God, so seven plus three together, something like that, anyhow, is the reason that seven is the number of completeness. So this is also an Old Testament quote from Isaiah 11, where the thing we say at confirmation, when we say, receive the spirit of counsel and of might, the spirit of wisdom and understanding, the spirit of knowledge and fear of the Lord. That's only six things. But it turns out that the Greek translation of the Old Testament that John used adds piety. So seven things about the Spirit of God in Isaiah 11. The fullness of God's Spirit, wisdom, counsel, might, power, understanding, all those things here. This letter to us here in Sardis is from the God who is, who was, and who is to come, and the fullness of the Spirit of God and Jesus Christ. And what about Jesus Christ? Three things. The faithful witness, we can count on what Jesus says. The firstborn of the dead, even if we go to the point of death, Jesus has power over death, and we can be the fifth born, the 20th born, the 1,000th born from the dead. And the ruler of the kings on earth. There it is, out and out clear. Jesus Christ is Lord is an alternative to Caesar as Lord. And then in chapter 5, similar picture of Jesus again. The new song in heaven, chapter 5, verses 9 and 10. We'll look at chapters 4 and 5 next more closely, but this new song, you, this is directed to the Lamb, to Jesus. You are worthy to take the scroll and open its seals. Why? For you were slaughtered because of your death, and by your blood you ransomed for God saints from every tribe and language and people and nation. Bible scholars tell us that this is a picture of buying back prisoners of war. You ransomed them by your blood. There were purchasing agents who would meet with the leaders of another country to say, well, we just finished our war. We know you have 1,000 of our people. Here's how much we'll pay you for them. Jesus is meeting with the Roman Empire or any tyrant and saying, I'm buying my people back. They belong to me by my blood. They're not to be prisoners of war of any other system or any other domination or authority. In other words, this is an Exodus image for those of us who've read the Old Testament again and again. God's going to free the people from slavery in Egypt, and that's going to happen again right here to us in Sardis and Laodicea and Thyatira and Philadelphia. And notice that saints will come from every tribe and language and people and nation. The Roman Empire is not the only one that can be like a pyramid with the emperor and the emperor's people on top and the civil servants and the nobles. And 95% of the population of the Roman Empire is kept in poverty and slavery in order to fuel the fine lifestyle of the 5%. It is not to be so in God's empire. Everyone in God's empire will be priests serving God, will have a position of authority and power, and will rule on earth. Another indication the revelation is not pie in the sky about some escapist time, but will rule on earth. This is a real practical message, this way of reading Revelation, anyhow, suggests it's a real practical way of reading it as a handbook for how do you live in tough times as God's faithful people. How do you live as God's faithful people when there are forces opposing the truth and justice and mercy of God at work in the world? What are some of the forces at work in the world now that you think seduce? What are our Roman empires? What are the forces at work in our world that keep us from living as God's priests?
Materialism.
Materialism. You want to say more about that?
Greed. Drive for business. The obsession with money and things. Glitter, buildings. We're living in the Roman Empire today. It's an extension of the old times.
Could you repeat that, John? I'm not sure.
Glitter, image, greed, the lust for money, materialism. He said, we're living in the Roman Empire right now. It's really not that different.
Militarism that we have today.
Militarism.
How we won the war.
How we won the war.
Mm-hmm. I think just busyness, too. And in college, it was always, how busy can you be? How many millions of activities can you be involved in? And it just seemed like you were running from one thing to another, and you never had time to stop and think about anything.
So with the result that you were living on the surface and didn't have a chance to get deeply into anything or see anything that was behind the curtain, sort of. Yeah, busyness and over-involvement. Any other powers at work in our world that keep the message of God from flourishing?
False gods, too.
False gods, for example?
Science and technology.
Science and technology in what way?
Well, that is the dominant religion in some sense, I think, of this country.
The dominant religion of this country in some ways is science and technology. And
that's the altar on which we put our faith.
That we put our faith there on that altar. We put our money there in terms of research and development. Luther says a God is who you turn to in time of need, the one on that you call on for help. And we look for answers to come from science and technology. Uh-huh.
I think education has become a God because it's a means to money and technology. And technology is a means to money.
And so we pursue an education because it will get the good life for us. And, yeah? Yeah? Yes?
Well, The bureaucratic and administrative mindset, which tries to put people in cubby holes and treat them for the convenience of the administrators and ignores their human potential.
People existing as cogs in a wheel for the sake of the system and not being individuals who have the full range of possibilities open to them. Is that a fair way of paraphrasing that?
The myth of being the strongest country in the world.
The myth of being the strongest country in the world. What kind of powers do these powers have over us to make us conform or to imply to us or to fool us into believing that they're the ones with the power and that we don't have choices?
Mass media.
Mass media. For example, can you think of one message mass media gives that brainwashes us?
You can have it all.
Television.
That you can have it all.
Yeah. Yeah. Or else you're not good enough unless you do this, this, and this, or buy this.
Right. You're not good enough without this deodorant or that car or something.
They could describe the world to in a certain way so that you believe that this is the world, this is the truth.
They give us images of the world that limit our images of how it could be different. We just sort of fall into that because we've seen it and heard it, and it's been that way on our screens.
And I think fear motivates us. We are afraid what would happen if we lose what we have.
So in other words, we're people who can go into the Book of Revelation not because of the Roman Empire, but because of the other emperors or tyrants or rulers or authorities that have power over our minds and over our values and over our social and economic system and political system and over our world, and hope to be changed in the same way that John hoped the message of the gospel would change the people in Philadelphia and Sardis and Thyatira. So Revelation is a relevant word, but it's relevant in a different way than a lot of people take it. A lot of people say Revelation is about the end of the world. It's a timeline or a calendar. Other people say Revelation is about the whole sweep of history, and it's the calendar, and so the dragon represents so-and-so, the big bear is Russia, such-and-such, the grasshoppers from the east are like the Egyptians overrunning Israel, and they have, you know, it all worked out like that. That, of course, depends on your point of view, and just think for a minute of a couple things. One thing is, why would the people in Sardis and Thyatira have kept the book if it didn't make any sense to them at all, and it was all going to happen 2,000 years later at some end of the world? Throw it out, you know. This is not an important book. It did mean something to them. And it means something to us because of the kinds of tyrants who appear and reappear and operate in subtle and in overt ways in our world. I'm not going to take a lot of time to dismantle the whole other ways of looking at Revelation. Maybe we can talk about that over coffee or something like that. Because what I would like to look at right now are more of the images of God, especially in chapters 4 and 5 of Revelation. I will say a couple words about the letters to the churches in Revelation 2 and 3. I read to you out loud that image of the one like the Son of Man standing with stars in his hands, a sword from his mouth, and so on. And each one of those images is part of the seven letters to the churches, to the seven churches. Most people can read the first three chapters of Revelation and make some sense of it. And that's why we won't spend a long time on it. But I will say that the more that you know about the place and the time when it was written, the more sense some of these things make. Maybe we'll look at the last letter of the seven, the one to Laodicea, Revelation chapter 3. Verses 14 to 22. Each one of these seven letters has a similar structure. It starts at the beginning with a salutation or an address to the angel of the church in Laodicea. write, or to the angel of the church in Philadelphia, or to the angel of the other churches. Angel is a word that means messenger. But it's also nice to think here about writing to the angel of a church. You know, different congregations have different personalities. If you've ever worshipped in a congregation, Holden has a personality of its own. And if you were to try to summarize what that personality, that inwardness of Holden is, you would be talking about the angel of the church of Holden Village. And if you were trying to describe what your worshiping community is like in a summary sort of way, its inwardness, its spirituality, you'd be talking about the angel of St. Luke Lutheran Church or Christ the King Episcopal Church or whatever community it is that you belong to. To the angel, to the totality, the spirituality of the church in Laodicea, write this. And here's this picture taken from that one of the one like the Son of Man of Jesus. The words of the Amen, the faithful and true witness, the origin of God's creation. I know your works. This is how the letters usually begin. And then there's an evaluation section. Some things that are applauded, some things that are condemned. Now, some of the letters only have applause. Some of the letters only have condemnation. Most of them have a little bit of both. I know your works. You're neither hot nor cold. I wish that you were either hot or cold. An interesting thing about Laodicea is that nearby there was a city that had hot springs and was famous for its hot springs, and also nearby a city that had a very cold well, cold running pure water. By the time those came together in Laodicea, the water was neither hot nor cold, but sort of lukewarm. And John is using that, Jesus is using that as an image for the kind of spirituality in the church in Laodicea. Neither hot nor cold, not with the healing virtues of a hot springs, not with the refreshing virtues of cold, pure water. So because you're lukewarm, neither hot nor cold, I'm about to spit you out of my mouth. Also being translated, vomit. For you say, I'm rich, I've prospered, and I need nothing. In fact, Laodicea was a banking center. And John is and Jesus are showing such an intimate knowledge of that particular place in this letter. You do not realize that you are wretched, pitiable, poor, blind, and naked. Therefore, I counsel you to buy from me gold refined by fire so that you may be rich. So the people in Laodicea are going to be saying, we rich, but we're the banking center of the area. We don't need to be rich. Buy white robes to clothe you and keep the shame of your nakedness from being seen. And the people in Laodicea are saying, well, wait a minute, we're famous for our sheep who have black wool, and we make a very fine fabric here out of black wool garments. What do we need white clothes for? Is something wrong with us? And salve to anoint your eyes so that you may see. Now, wait a minute, we have a medical school here in Laodicea, and one of the things we're famous for is the ointment for eyes that we make here. What do you mean that we're blind and we need salve? Just trying to undercut, satirize, trying to hold a mirror up to them so that they see their real situation and not make the assumptions they've been making all along. I reprove and discipline those whom I love. Again, the assurance that Jesus loves them. Be earnest, therefore, and repent. Listen, I'm standing at the door knocking. If you hear my voice and open the door, I'll come into you and eat with you. We'll be a community again. We'll be hospitable to one another. And you with me. And then these letters after the evaluation section ends with a promise to those who conquer. Military language. Again, it's setting up the alternative to the Roman system. But how are the Christians going to conquer? Not by taking up the sword, but by the power of their witness to the gospel, to Jesus Christ, by their words, by their civil disobedience, if you will, and by their loving support for one another in that effort. To the one who conquers, I'll give a place with me on my throne, just as I myself conquered and sat down with my Father on his throne. Let anyone who has an ear listen to what the Spirit is saying to the churches, not just to this church. And again, writing to seven churches, John, I've just tried to show that John's writing particularly to the ones who are there, but also in general to anyone who needs to hear the word that's there, to all of the churches, in all that place and time, in all places and all times, an ongoing word. It's kind of an eavesdropping method of Bible study. We try to overhear what it meant to them And then we say, does the shoe fit? Can we wear this? What can we figure out from this? Take a minute to think what you would say to your worshiping community if you were writing such a letter to its angel. Who does Jesus need to be to address an authoritative word to your community? And what applause and what condemnation would Jesus be offering? What are the strengths and the weaknesses of your community? And what's the encouragement and promise that Jesus would give at the end of this message? Let anyone who has an ear listen to what the Spirit is saying to the churches. And now we're ready to look in fast outline fashion at Revelation 4 and 5. I was saying most people can read the letters and make some sense of them, but boy, things start getting weird when you get into chapter 4 because a door to heaven opens and all of a sudden there are wonderful, strange figures there. The very first thing that John sees in verse 2 is one seated on the throne. And the description goes on to describe gems. So when you're in the lapidary, think of God's throne when you're there. And in verse 4, around the throne are 24 thrones with 24 elders seated on the throne. What do you think that stands for, 24? Be versed in the Hebrew scriptures again. 12 and 12. So 12 tribes of Israel. What's the other 12 for?
Apostles.
12 apostles is a good bet. And so what's represented by these 24 elders on the thrones? The fullness of God's people. The whole history of salvation. The people in the promise of Abraham and the people in the promise of Christ. And then there's in verses 5 and 6 the kind of imagery, again drawn from the Old Testament, that was like on Mount Sinai when God gave the commandments. Or whenever there was a revelation of God, smoke and thunder and flashes of lightning and so on. A lot of these images come from the book of Ezekiel, too. If you just read the first few chapters of Ezekiel, first two chapters of Ezekiel, you'll be amazed at how much John has picked up and reused there. Around the throne and on each side of the throne, this is the second half of verse 6, are four living creatures. Now, they're full of eyes and wings. What I want to look at now is what they represent. Again, these four creatures appear in Ezekiel, where we'd say probably that they're the cherubim. But think of them in this context where we're getting a picture of the whole throne room, the whole Roman dome, but this is God's heavenly dome. This is the alternative to the Roman Empire that we have here. We have a creature with that's like a lion, another one like an ox, another one with a human face, and another one like a flying eagle. It reminds me of many of the living creatures, the domesticated animals in the ox, the wild animals with the lion, the human animals with the human, the flying animals with the bird, right there next to God's throne. I think deep ecologists should, and creation spiritual or theologians should take note of these chapters in Revelation, because right up close to the throne are representatives of all created beings. And they sing all the time, holy, 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 in verse 8. And then in verse 9, whenever the living creatures give glory and honor and thanks to the one seated on the throne, the 24 elders fall down and cast their crowns before the throne. Now, in the Roman Empire, in Rome, any king who'd been conquered in the previous year would have to come and cast his crown before Caesar, before the emperor. So if he was lucky, the Roman emperor might get 2, 3, 8, 10 crowns in a year. In heaven, the one seated on the throne gets 24 crowns every time the four living creatures sing holy, 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 and they sing holy, holy, holy constantly and repeatedly. And the picture multiplies and magnifies even beyond this. In the beginning of chapter 5, a scroll is there, a rolled up piece of parchment or paper or leather, and sealed with seven seals, the hot wax put over the part where you'd unroll it so that you can't unroll it without breaking the seals, so that it has to remain closed and confidential until, or you can tell if someone's read it ahead of time. This scroll must have the secret of everything that we want to know in it. What does our suffering mean? Why is Rome in power? Why are there tyrants? Are tyrants really going to rule the world? Who should we worship? All those answers sealed up in this scroll. And no one on heaven and earth worthy to open the scroll. Wait a minute, no one? Not even the emperor in Rome is worthy to open this scroll? The emperor is no better off than we are. Ha, 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 ha. There's good news to this, even though it's also sad. How are we ever going to find out what life is all about if no one can open the scroll? And so John begins to cry. And one of the elders says, "Don't weep, the lion has conquered, so he can open the scroll and its seven seals." And we're ready for this, like Aslan in the Narnia books, to come leaping out and roar, and the scroll will open. And who comes forth but a lamb? As Dan Erlander says, we're waiting for the lion and Fluffy comes out. The lamb who looks as if it's been slaughtered. That's the one who's worthy to open the scroll. The lamb, the Passover symbol. Again, this is an Exodus image. We're going to be freed from slavery. The lamb is an image of Jesus who was slain, whose blood marks the doorposts of our souls and our lives so that we can be freed, and the lamb is worthy. And then we come to the section in verses 9 and 10 where those first themes about Jesus and what Jesus has done are repeated. Slaughtered, by your blood you ransomed from God, and so on, and you've made us to be a kingdom and priests serving our God, and we will reign on earth. Now add to this, you know, it's like an ever-expanding circle, add to this many angels, myriads of myriads and thousands singing with full voice. This has obviously got to be on cinema with surround sound and all that sort of stuff. And then add in verse 13, as if this were not enough, every creature in heaven and on earth and under the earth and in the sea and all that is in them. Has anyone been forgotten that you can think of? I think everyone is here worshiping the one on the throne and the Lamb. And folks, this is the alternative to the emperor in Rome, who says he has power, who in fact has sufficient power of some sort to build a Colosseum with the slave labor of 70,000 Jews who were forced there at sword point and made to do the bidding of the emperor. And the Colosseum, where 5,000 wild animals can be killed for the sport and play of the opening festivities of the Colosseum. That's the alternative to this heavenly vision where people of free accord and animals of their free accord and the whole creation, visible and invisible, are in a wonderful series of concentric circles in a sphere praising the only one who was, who is, and who is to come, and who has all power, and to the Lamb who was slain, who has begun to reign. Now, which are we going to choose? Problem, of course, is that it's easy to forget that this is real. In Eastern Orthodox churches, when you go in, they say you are joining the heavenly chorus where worship never ceases. It's not like you don't worship all week and then there's a couple hours of worship. It is like the true reality of the universe is that worship is always going on and we only tap into it a couple times in the week, or maybe, you know, once a day if we're blessed and lucky and disciplined or whatever it takes. And the rest of Revelation then is set up so that we can get indelible images in our imaginations that will remind us of this ceaseless worship and of our place in it and of our dignity in it, of our empowerment through it. so that we can stand up and do what needs to be done here in Holden Village and Seattle and Boise and Portland and Minneapolis and wherever else we come from. Closing comments from you? Well, then I'd like to end with something really corny. Oh, you have one. Sorry, Bill.
State.
Yeah.
That's just a comment. If you'll notice on the kiosk over there that under the name Bill Strelo, which is me, there is a title called Village Philosopher, which is rather presumptuous. But one of the things that I hope to do here with you this week is to make some connections between the various experiences and classes that you have. And I just to explain that, I'd like to backtrack a little bit of what Joan said in terms of the angel of Holden Village. You've been lured to this place by God, to this angel, and I hope that we can experience what that angel has to offer. So as we get deeper into the week, and as questions may arise, as revelation may occur, and sometimes a revelatory experience with God cause conflict within ourselves, within our learnings that may not really relate to what we think church ought to be, I invite you to gather in groups, and I would be willing to sit and discuss things with you that are left untangled, unanswered. So as you start to experience the week and experience the angel that is Holden and experience the revelatory power that is this place, please gather together, and if we need to take some time in small groups to help answer some leftover questions, that's what my purpose is. So I make that introduction.
I'm glad I had the breathing time, because there's a definite connection between what we experienced yesterday in worship on Soweto Day with the Book of Revelation. Alan Bosack, who is a leader of the struggle for freedom in South Africa, who's written the book that made Revelation come alive for me, Comfort and Protest, available in the library or in the bookstore here, says that these songs of this whole creation gathered around the one on the throne and the Lamb are freedom songs that are being sung all the time. Freedom songs that empower the people to remember who they are. And he's got this passage about freedom songs. This joyful noise frightens the oppressor. He cannot stand it. Black people in South Africa have made freedom songs part of the struggle. In fact, the struggle is inconceivable without them. Marching down the streets, facing the police and army troops of the South African government, they sing. In jail, they sing songs of defiance and faith and freedom. It makes the jailers nervous. In prison, singing is not allowed, but political prisoners do it anyway, their voices blending as the song is picked up from cell to cell until the prison resounds with music that celebrates the coming victory. Prison wardens, policemen, and heavily armed soldiers cannot understand how people can sing under such circumstances. The more joyful the singing, the more aggressive they become. And so over the last few years, we've learned another valuable lesson. The joy of the oppressed is a source of fear for the oppressor. But we sing because we believe. We sing because we hope. We sing because we know that it is only a little while and the tyrant shall cease to exist. And fortunately, that's kept from the corny ending I thought we might do, which is to sing the Star Trek theme with the word amen. It kind of was like this, amen. Thanks, have a good day.